The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, what do the latest studies into our sexual orientation reveal? Are there dangers in framing sexuality through the lens of genetics? And what are the next stages in the fight against Ebola? We speak to one of the world's leading authorities in infectious diseases. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Dr. Alan R. Sanders is a psychiatrist at North Shore University Health System Research Institute in Chicago. He's been carrying out large-scale research with 400 pairs of homosexual brothers to look at the genetic contribution to sexual orientation in men. His latest paper appears in the journal Psychological Medicine. I spoke to Dr. Sanders down the line and began by asking him about the background to his research.
Well, back in 1993, Dean Hamer published his first linkage study on 40 pairs of gay brothers, and they found linkage to a chromosomal region on chromosome X called XQ28. Generated a lot of press and discussion at the time. That was quite a while ago, a little bit over 20 years ago. Their group had a paper a couple of years later, in 1995, where they replicated that in another 33 brother pairs. Several other groups with similar size samples, say around 50 pairs of brothers, have tried to replicate that but have not had much success afterwards. A possible reason for that might be that the sample sizes were not large enough to carry enough statistical power, which is the ability to find something there that is there to be found. And that motivated us to undertake our current study. We were one of the groups back in the mid to late 1990s that did collect a few brother pairs. We had 54 pairs of brothers back then. And we had this kind of equivocal finding. It didn't meet the standards for replication, but it wasn't real far from it. And so we decided we would try to collect a much larger sample size to give a fair shot at replication and also whatever we might be able to find, you know, on our own. So that prompted us to apply for a grant, eventually got a grant, collected the sample, and that's what the current paper is referring to, these 409 pairs of gay brothers that we did the linkage scan on.
Before I get you to go through that study, just take me through why there was such a fuss around Dean Hamer's paper in 93. What were the issues that people were upset about or concerned about?
Well, I think people were surprised. There was such a strong linkage with that sample size, fairly small sample size.
What do you really mean by linkage?
Linkage is when you find a region on a chromosome that seems to travel with the trait linked through the generation, so to speak.
So not specifically a gene, but an area on a chromosome that seems to be playing some role in that trait.
Yes, you have to kind of separate out a little bit when people talk about simple Mendelian one gene, one trait, or one disease kind of scenarios, then linkage can be more precise. But with most things that people study nowadays, whether it's traits like sexual orientation or intelligence or height or various diseases like diabetes or cancer or schizophrenia, asthma, whatever, they tend to be in the realm of what's called complex genetics. That means multiple genetic contributions, not just one gene, and also environment, that is non-genetic contributions being important. For these complex genetic scenarios, the linkage peaks are not real steep or precise. They cover a larger region on a chromosome, maybe 20 to 40 centimorgans, which is a type of genetic distance. It's roughly equivalent to, say, 20 to 40 million base pairs, and there can be dozens or hundreds of genes under those kind of linkage peaks.
But were people kind of fundamentally concerned about the idea of just talking about a genetic component of homosexuality? And I presume people bandied around the term gay gene.
Well, so that's sort of like shorthand that some folks use, but it's not so accurate for a number of reasons, which I'll briefly list off. You know, one is that we think multiple genes are involved. We have information indicating that from things like family studies, twin studies, and now from linkage studies. We also don't really think of it as a gay gene. It's not like the gene is gay or the gene is straight or any gene that contributes to variation in the trait. So, I mean, whatever genetic variants we eventually end up narrowing down to that influence the trait, you know, one form of the variant might increase the chance you'd be straight. Another form might increase the chance you would be gay. So they're really variations in the DNA that have some influence on variation in the trait itself.
What is the kind of scientific case for these kind of studies? I mean, I think some people will probably say, why are you looking at genetics for sexual orientation?
Well, the reason I'd say probably most people study sexual orientation, whether it's with genetic means or other study strategies, is that sexual orientation is a pretty major part of our psychological makeup. It's not the end-all and be-all, but it's a pretty significant part, and there's not that much known about its development. And so there's a general basic science, if you will, kind of interest in studying it.
Take us through what your latest study found. This was essentially repeating some of these earlier studies, but with a far higher number of people involved.
It was pursuing a linkage approach, which is like the other linkage studies did, of course. It was a larger sample. It's about three times as big as the next biggest study. It was a whole genome study, meaning we looked at all the chromosomes. Some of the earlier studies had only looked at the X chromosome or even maybe just a few markers on the X chromosome, but we looked at all the chromosomes, not just the X chromosome. And we also used a newer genotyping method, relatively newer than some of the older studies, which involved a lot more markers across the genome that will enable us to then pursue the next main study, which will be a genome-wide association study. But this current study is a linkage study.
And the results you find, what are the areas you pick out in the whole genome that seem to be related to sexual orientation?
Well, so our strongest finding was on chromosome 8, where we had a two-point linkage finding that was genome-wide significant, meaning that you are not likely to have such a finding 5% or less by chance every time you do a whole genome scan. When we say two-point linkage, we mean just one marker versus the trait, those being the two points. It also had multi-point support, and what we mean by multi-point linkage support is that information from nearby, you know, neighboring genetic markers on the same region of the chromosome were also supportive. And when we looked back at, like I mentioned, the next biggest genome-wide linkage study, which was on a bit over 150 pairs of brothers, that was their second strongest finding. So our strongest finding had that kind of support from the previous literature. Our second strongest finding to us seemed to be on chromosome X at XQ28. It wasn't quite as significant on the two-point linkage, but it had pretty strong multi-point support. And that, of course, was the previously reported linkage region from Dean Hamer's studies. So that was pretty consistent as well. So we think the convergence of this evidence points to the likelihood that there's one or more genes in each of these regions that influence the development of male sexual orientation. One of your earlier questions jogged my mind as something to mention. Sometimes people ask, well, why are you studying families of gay brothers? And it's just that, you know, say, as opposed to studying a bunch of families with straight brothers, it's a lot more efficient or economical to, with these statistical and genetic methods, to focus on the less common form of the trait. So that's why we focus on gay men. It's the same reason when people study illnesses with these same kind of techniques, they focus on, say, families that have siblings that both have the condition, whatever it is they're studying.
Those two regions you've identified on chromosome 8 and on the X chromosome, is there anything that you can infer about what is happening in those regions, what the mechanism might be for how those regions are involved in altering sexual orientation, predisposing sexual orientation one way or the other?
I'd say it's kind of premature for that. Like I say, under each of these linkage peaks, there's dozens, maybe hundreds of genes. And I would say, you know, with any area with 100 genes or so, I could probably look through the list and come up with some kind of story as to why one or more of those genes might have some relevance. It would be speculation, and we do speculate on some of the genes under these linkage peaks in the paper. But like I say, linkage mapping with complex genetic scenarios is not so precise. So before we really start more seriously talking about individual genes, I think we'll need to wait to see what the genome-wide association studies, which can map things a lot more precisely to one or a much smaller number of genes of interest. And then there's, of course, follow-up study methods once you get things narrowed down that much.
How are genes that predispose someone towards homosexuality remain in the gene pool? I know there's an argument for a gene on the X chromosome, but take me through the arguments for our listeners.
So that's another area of interest. You know, another reason why personally I was interested in studying this area is there's this thing called the evolutionary conundrum or paradox, and it briefly goes like this, that sexual orientation is somewhat genetic. The twin studies tell us maybe 30 or 40% of the variation in the trait is due to genetic contributions. We know that gay men have a lot fewer biological offspring than straight men for obvious reasons, and that's not just speculated on, but studies have confirmed that. Yet there's a fairly substantial proportion of the population of men that's gay, maybe 3-4% of men being gay. So if evolution selects genes that are predisposed to reproductive fitness, in other words, are passed on to the next generation, you know, how would that work? You would kind of think that maybe the genes predisposing to homosexuality would diminish over time because they wouldn't be passed on as much to future generations. But that doesn't seem to be the case. So it's kind of a paradox on that level. And there's a number of ways people have hypothesized to explain that. But one of the main predictions is that perhaps there's something like sexually antagonistic selection going on, which is a bit of a mouthful of words to swallow, but what it means is that maybe genes predisposing to sexual orientation one way or another, maybe they act differently in men versus women. And on the X chromosome, it's kind of a setup to perhaps even be a stronger effect because men have an X and a Y chromosome. Women have two X chromosomes. So in that sense, the X chromosome spends essentially twice as much time in women as in men. And so you could have a gene on the X chromosome that a variant would increase the chance of males being gay, and they'd have fewer offspring. But maybe in women, it would somehow, and there's different speculation about how this could occur, it would somehow increase the number of children that the women would have, and this could balance things out. So balancing selection or and sexual antagonism are some words you hear bandied about. So those kind of theories or hypotheses predict that there would be a locus on the X chromosome influence in male sexual orientation, which is, you know, consistent with what we found.
So with genetics playing something like a 30 to 40% contribution in all of this, in sexual orientation, what are speculated as being the other factors, what we'll call the environmental factors, but that's a phrase that can sort of easily be misunderstood. People might think that's sort of, things floating around in the air or whatever.
Right. Well, so when people use environment in the sense of genes and environment's everything else besides genetics. So it includes stuff in your environment, but it includes things like psychological and social, and it includes all the rest of biology besides genetics. So, you know, everything but genetics. There's been a lot of different speculations over the years, but really the contribution that is by far on the most solid footing, you know, up there with genetics, is the number of older brothers that a man has. The more biological older brothers a guy has, the higher chance that he will be gay. And so this is a very early biological kind of contribution as well, an environmental contribution, if you will.
How does that work?
It's not exactly known how that works, but the leading hypothesis is that maybe it's some kind of immunological mechanism. Ray Blanchard and his colleagues have really kind of pioneered this area up in Canada, but the idea goes along like this, that maybe there's some male-specific antigens possibly that somehow stimulate the maternal immune system, and this becomes stronger with each successive pregnancy, as immunological responses tend to do. And somehow whatever this response is can get across to, say, the developing fetus and have some influence on whatever parts of the brain might be relevant for developing this or that sexual orientation. So that's the hypothesis as to how such a phenomenon, such as the older brother effect, might work. And part of that rests on the findings that it's only an effect in men. It doesn't influence female sexual orientation. And it's also only an effect of the older brothers, not the number of older sisters.
We talked earlier about the fuss that greeted Dean Hamer's work. How is it these days for researchers working on this this question? Do you still get a sort of mixed response to it? Do you still get criticized?
Well, of course, things have changed a lot, you know, in 20-some-odd years, and the social and cultural environment in many places, for sure, over here in the U.S., so things are quite a bit different. They're different even than when we started this study. So the proportion of people upset versus the proportion of people happy or invested in this kind of research going on is much, much different now than it was when we first started out. It's you know, less controversial, but it's still a controversial area of research, whether we're talking about sexual orientation or genetics and, you know, putting them both together. And there's different kinds of hopes and concerns across the social, cultural, political spectrum.
Something that always comes up with this work is if you start honing in on particular genes that affect sexual orientation, and people then say, well, you may have some group wanting to do a test for homosexuality in embryos or something, and or that it changes this view from, maybe this is a positive effect of changing this view from sexual orientation being a choice to being something that's sort of biologically handed to you. But you tell me what you see as the sort of controversial areas around this.
Well, so you hit on some of the reasons why some people are interested or against this kind of research. One revolves around this choice debate, and I think that's one thing that has changed over here in the U.S. Over the previous years. You know, one of the things that was I think surprising to many people when Dean Hamer's findings came out is, you know, sexual orientation, is it somewhat inborn, somewhat genetic? And it is somewhat genetic. And so that tends to erode notions of choice, like I'm going to choose to be this or that sexual orientation. So I think even a lot of the people who were invested in portraying sexual orientation as a choice have somewhat backed away from that. Now they tend to emphasize that, okay, well, maybe you didn't choose to be gay, and for that matter, maybe you didn't choose to be straight, but you are what you are. But their argument will go, well, what is your behavior going to be? What are you going to do even though you have this or that orientation? So anyway, biological research like this does tend to erode somewhat this notion of a simple choice scenario, and that is something that some people are interested in doing and other people are not interested in doing. And so that would be the kind of thing, say, when we go to the gay pride festivals, many people would be interested in participating to, you know, contribute to biological research. But one of the things many people might be concerned about is, well, what might be done eventually with such genetic knowledge? They might be concerned a test would be developed that could be used in various discriminatory ways, even to maybe abort babies likely to be gay and stuff like that. So, and it's understandable people would have such concerns, but it turns out with complex genetic scenarios, and certainly with sexual orientation, we're not talking about one gene or ever like there would be a very predictive kind of test that would be used this way. It's certainly not our goal to develop such a test, but that begs the question, what might other people do with such knowledge? But I don't really see how any kind of test with enough predictive power could be developed to be used or misused in any of these ways. But that is a concern that people have had.
Simply because that genetic component is so small. I mean, I think if it's 30 to 40%, then tossing a coin is going to give you a better, more accurate result.
Yes, and a lot of people are coming from the scenario of, well, you know, what about sexual selection? but you can totally tell whether the baby is XX or XY, and in different countries and different settings that has been used. But we are extremely far from anything like that with complex genetic traits.
Finally, Alan, I just wanted to ask you when your genome-wide association study might be going ahead, when you think you may have some results coming out of that study.
Well, hopefully that might come out sometime next year. We're currently in the final analysis stages and starting to write up our findings. But these things do take time, but I wouldn't look at to take near the time that it did for our linkage study and that to proceed.
Alan, thanks so much for joining us today. Fascinating to hear about your research.
Thank you. I sure appreciate it.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
The Ebola outbreak has been dominating headlines recently, not least with the Queen expressing her concern that other deadly conditions like malaria were being overshadowed. Professor David Heyman is head of the Centre on Global Health Security at Chatham House, London, and Professor of Infectious Disease Epidemiology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He's been at the forefront of the fight against Ebola since it was first identified in 1976. I began by asking him whether there were any signs that the epidemic in West Africa has begun to slow down.
Well, there are actually reports from in the field, and these are anecdotal reports and also some confirmed, that there is a decrease in the number of patients presenting to health facilities, and that hopefully means that there's also a decrease in patients in the community. But as you know, early on in the outbreak, patients have been kept in the community. They've been hidden in some instances, and this was all because of a misunderstanding about what needed to be done with the epidemic. But now people seem to be understanding that this is a very contagious disease if you touch a patient, and they're hopefully avoiding direct contact with patients while making sure that there's a respectful transport to the hospital for those that are sick and respectful burial of those who are dead.
What are the measures that seem to be having the most impact, or do you see coming in as having the most impact?
Well, it's been known since the first outbreaks that there are three strategies which will stop Ebola, and those strategies are being applied in West Africa as well, and they include rapid identification of patients and then their isolation in health facilities where health workers are protected and where transmission doesn't continue to other patients. The second is community understanding, making sure that communities understand about the outbreak, they understand how to prevent themselves from being infected, and they help civil society create mechanisms where patients can be safely transported, where dead bodies can be respectfully buried, and also where there's a system to clean out households after patients have left houses. So that's the second strategy. And then the third, and probably the most important, is contact tracing. Finding all persons who have been in contact with a patient, making sure that they're taking their temperature twice a day or that their temperature is taken twice a day. And if they develop a fever, then diagnosing what the cause is, and if it's Ebola, isolating them. So those are the three strategies that have worked in the past, and they're working to a certain extent in urban areas in West Africa, but it's quite a challenge in those areas because there's not the same organization that there is in rural communities where this disease emerges.
And is the reason that this epidemic became so big in West African states because the expertise, the experience wasn't there, or was it because of these were more urban areas?
Well, there was Ebola in West Africa before. There was an outbreak among chimpanzees in the Thai forest, which is just next to Liberia. And in that outbreak, a Swiss veterinarian was infected and was expatriated to Switzerland, not knowing what she had, but in the end she had Ebola and she recovered. At the same time, there were reports of cases at that time in Liberia as well. So Ebola has been in West Africa. It just wasn't recognized as being there by many of the health authorities. And that maybe was a problem in making health authorities aware that this disease was present. What's clear about Ebola, though, is that it emerges in rural areas. It emerges usually to one person, from somewhere in nature to a person, and then that person spreads it to others, either by direct contact, and most often by contact within a hospital where hospital practices amplify transmission. Health workers become infected. They then take it out to others in the community. But all outbreaks occur with just one initial case, which is infected from nature.
There's been a lot written about the call for an international response and that international response to this. How has that played out from your eyes?
Well, there's very much goodwill, both internationally and actually having gone to countries, whether it's non-governmental organizations like Save the Children or government organizations like Public Health England or CDC from Atlanta or Doctors Without Borders. Many have responded to the call. What's important, though, is that there be strong coordination of that response in the countries. And this means that governments must help people see where they should work and what's needed. And governments need to be supported in doing that job by the UN and other systems. I understand that early on in the outbreaks, coordination was very weak, but it is increasing. Governments are being better supported by the UN system and others to coordinate activities. Public Health England, for example, has someone in the office in Sierra Leone which is coordinating the response there. And gradually gaps are being identified, and this goodwill that's coming in the form of NGOs and governments and others is being channeled to the right places where there is a need.
What actually has to happen on the ground, though, to turn that goodwill into something very effective that will bring the outbreak under control?
Well, we know the strategies that will bring it under control. What's important is that the international collaboration and partners work with countries to assure that, whether it's management of patients in hospitals and protection of health workers, contact tracing, which is basic shoe leather epidemiology, identifying contacts and making sure that their temperature is taken, and also helping communities understand. And there's where the Red Cross, Red Crescent societies, and others are very useful, working with community organizations to be sure that there are transport systems in place for patients, for dead bodies, and also that people understand how transmission occurs. Because once people understand, they will prevent themselves from becoming infected. This has happened in 25 previous outbreaks. It will happen here.
The World Health Organization has put out an urgent call for a new diagnostic test, one that will be faster but still sensitive, reliable, safe, and so on, to pick up patients with Ebola more quickly. What is the problem with the test that's being used at the moment in this environment?
The ideal diagnostic test is one that a health worker can take to the patient and within a period of 20 minutes or so or even less tell whether that patient is infected with Ebola or not. That's what's needed. Because if that is available, the diagnosis can be done very rapidly, patients can be isolated very rapidly, and the outbreak can come under control even more rapidly. So that's what's needed. What we have now is a test which takes between 6 and 8 hours to really identify whether or not a patient is infected with Ebola, and that must be done in a laboratory. It's not a point-of-care diagnostic where the diagnosis goes to the patient. It's where the patient's blood sample goes to the laboratory. So all that takes time, clearly, depending on the logistics system, the distance from the laboratory, and the ability of the laboratories to really handle all the specimens that come in.
Isn't it a bit late to come out with a call for a new diagnostic like that, though? Wasn't there a need for that seen earlier on?
Well, there was a need for vaccines, medicines, and diagnostic tests early on. But, you know, there's an understanding of why this wasn't ready, because past outbreaks have been very small, rapidly contained, as could this one have been contained had it been responded to properly early on when it was first identified in Guinea. Undoubtedly, it could have been stopped then, but it wasn't. So now we're in a position where we would like to have vaccines, we would like to have point-of-care diagnostics, and we would like to have medicines that can treat patients. So, you know, it's late in the game, but there will be other outbreaks, and what's important is to understand that you can only try these strategies and new products during an epidemic when the virus is circulating in human populations.
You mentioned the vaccines and the clinical trials underway. Have you seen any modelling that shows how effective those vaccines might be in terms of saving lives in the outbreak? And depending on how it's used, how the outbreak plays out?
Well, it's clear that if a vaccine were available and it were effective, then the first target populations would be health workers and those people who are transporting patients or dead bodies, all frontline workers. And it would be wonderful if they could be protected, because it's through them that the virus gets from hospitals into the community. So that would be an ideal population to vaccinate. In addition, there are talks about going to communities where the virus is circulating and either doing what's called a ring vaccination around a patient and all the contacts of that patient or potential contacts, or vaccinating the whole community. So there are strategies which could be used, but there isn't a vaccine at present. As you know, the U.S. has invested in research to develop vaccines, drugs, and antibody preparations and diagnostic tests, because Ebola virus is found on a list of pathogens which the U.S. considers could be used for bioterrorism. So that research and development has developed vaccines, medicines, antibody treatments, and diagnostic tests which would be suitable for use in outbreaks. The study, though, has not gotten out of the laboratory where they've been shown to be useful and effective in protecting animal populations. Now the challenge is to rev up the studies so that these medicines or vaccines can be shown to be safe in humans and then test them for effectiveness.
When do you think that vaccine or a vaccine will be available?
Well, it's not clear when the vaccine will be available. It's understood that possibly trials could begin sometime early in the new year. But what's important is that there are some possibilities now of saving lives. First off is understanding how to best maintain hydration of patients, being sure that the balance internally is maintained as you provide fluids so that patients can survive long enough that their own immune system can take over and neutralize the virus. So there are estimates that you could decrease the case fatality rate, the fatality rate from Ebola, quite significantly if patients were managed in the best possible manner, as they are in industrialized countries. At the same time, survivors have antibody in their blood to this virus, and it's important that those antibodies be studied to see whether or not they are effective in neutralizing the antibody in people who are infected. After the first outbreak in 1976, I stayed on for a period of 2.5 months to collect blood from survivors and separate the antibody from that blood, and that was stocked throughout Africa for the next outbreak. Fortunately, the next outbreak didn't occur for 20 years. Unfortunately, that plasma, that antibody, was no longer useful because it had become outdated. But those studies need to be done now to see whether or not this antibody can protect patients. And if it's effective in doing so, it could add to the credibility of health facilities. Patients would be more attracted to come into health facilities, and we could be saving more lives.
And this brings in the idea of actually convalescent serum, correct?
That's what this is, yes.
Yeah, so instead of a preparation made purely with the antibodies, it's actually taking serum, the plasma from patients who have recovered, the antibodies within that serum potentially helping people to get over the infection when they're diagnosed.
That's right. In the research and development program for medicines and treatments for Ebola, there have been some monoclonal antibody preparations developed. These are antibodies against the virus, and these are grown on tobacco leaves. And hopefully that antibody will have an impact on the virus. But there is a natural way of doing this, and that is collecting convalescent bloods from survivors, and extracting the antibody from that and seeing whether that's effective in neutralizing the virus in people who are infected.
David, there has been another outbreak in Africa while attention has been focused on the West African epidemic.
Yes, that's right. While attention has been focused on this terrible outbreak in West Africa, there was an outbreak that began in the Democratic Republic of Congo in August of this year, and by October it was already contained, with only 80 people having been affected. This outbreak is thought to have occurred when a woman went to a market and bought a live animal. She came home with that animal, butchered it, and probably from the blood of that animal became infected with the Ebola virus. She then infected a child in her family, but she also was admitted to the hospital where 8 health workers became infected, and they then served as an entry point into the community, and there was an outbreak of about 80 people. some of whom died. In fact, about half of them, unfortunately, died. The outbreak was jumped on rapidly by the government of DRC, along with international partners from MSF, CDC, and other places, including WHO, and that outbreak was stopped. This is the way we can make sure that outbreaks don't become urban, is stopping them in rural areas.
People have talked about the possibility of cases coming to the UK. I know this is a global problem, you know, centred in Africa. I don't want to make this a UK story, but is there still that likelihood, do you think?
Well, as long as that virus is circulating in the world, there's a possibility that it will end up in another country. We've seen this with SARS. We've seen this with almost every major outbreak which occurred, and we've also seen it with antimicrobial resistant organisms. We know that in a globalized world, infections travel. They travel in the incubation period many times when no one is aware that they're even traveling around the world. That's what happened in the U.S. when someone from Liberia was infected, arrived in the U.S., was asymptomatic, but a few days later developed a fever. So we know that these things will continue to travel around the world, and the best defense is for countries to have good alert and response systems to deal with these outbreaks when and where they occur.
Is there a risk that all of this focus on Ebola is going to distract attention away from other diseases like malaria, other more infectious diseases that are killing more people?
What's happening in Sierra Leone and in Liberia and in Guinea is that health facilities are oversaturated with patients from Ebola. And therefore, health workers, many of whom have died, unfortunately, are in scarce supply. And so the fear is that people who have common infections like malaria, like a diarrheal disease, HIV, for example, are not seen in health facilities because the health facilities are not accessible to them because they're overburdened with Ebola patients, and therefore they're not being diagnosed and treated. And the fear is that they will not be treated and mortality will increase from common diseases like malaria and also from vaccine-preventable diseases such as measles if vaccinations are no longer being given.
So what do we do about that? How do we prevent that?
Well, it's a very difficult situation to prevent. What needs to be done is we need to think for the next time how to make health systems more resilient. And that includes a whole series of measures which will make sure that the common diseases can also be treated during an outbreak. But the most important to remember is that Ebola usually emerges in rural areas, and a rapid containment in that rural area will prevent what we're seeing today.
What are the lessons that need to be learned locally for preparation for the next time? It may not be lessons, maybe it's infrastructure. I mean, is there not a danger that after this epidemic has been brought under control and stopped, that everyone packs up and goes home and the place is as vulnerable as it ever was to another outbreak 10 years' time, 15 years' time?
There certainly is a danger that after this outbreak, as has happened in many outbreaks in the past, the global community packs up and goes home. But there is an international agreement, international regulations, which have been established since 1969 and which were modified after the SARS outbreak, which require countries to develop 8 core capacities in public health. Those capacities range from public health laboratories to field epidemiology training to risk communication, a whole series of activities which would make countries able to rapidly detect and respond to disease when it occurs. There was a 7-year clause in that revision. The revision of the international health regulations came into force in 2007, and within 7 years after that, countries were all throughout the world required to develop those core capacities. This was agreed by all member countries of WHO in 2005, and what happened in 2014 is we've had major outbreaks of Ebola, which show that this was not done. These 8 core capacities were not strengthened. How do we make sure they're strengthened after the outbreak? Well, what we need to do is make sure that development agencies buy into this framework and provide support to countries to develop these core capacities. And we need to make sure that there's a mechanism which can assess whether or not countries have reached that core capacity. The mechanism built into the international health regulations is a self-assessment. We all know that self-assessments are not the best way to identify whether or not there's a problem. This needs to be done externally. So hopefully, after this outbreak, there will be some external assessments done. Country capacities will be strengthened by development agencies, and we won't see such a serious outbreak in the future.
That's all we have for you this week. A big thanks to Professor David Heyman and Dr. Alan Sanders. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.
The Guardian.